power began to assert itself once he began to apprehend the world around him. Coming into his strength as a young man, Douglas became aware that the world held opportunities for forbidden learning in unlikely places. Consider this example of gumption. Douglas was sent by Auld to work at Durgan and Bailey's shipyard down at the wharf. As he worked alongside the builders of wooden ships, he began to notice that once they had completed crafting a piece of the ship, a plank, a frame, or knee, they would write two letters upon the piece to signify where on the ship the piece fit. If it was for the starboard side, forward, they would mark the piece with an SF, and if the larboard side, rear, or aft, then upon the plank would be written LA, and so on. By means of assiduous studying, Frederick Douglass was able to surreptitiously master his first four letters. Since he was unable to continue his education at home, Douglass began to secret away small hunks of bread to exchange for quick lessons with neighborhood white boys of his own age. He collected every stray newspaper and brochure, and his knowledge grew incrementally, one letter and then one word at a time. On the next occasion in which your put-upon kid bitches about a spelling test, please relay this anecdote to him or her. The Aulds had a son named Thomas, who was learning to read and write in school right out in the open, so I guess he must have been a white kid, and this Thomas had practiced his writing skills in several copybooks which were kept in the house. On Mondays, when he was left alone to mind the house, risking a vicious beating, if not worse, Douglas took to copying Master Thomas's sentences over again in the spaces between the lines, tediously self-training his hand and brain until he finally succeeded in learning to write. Okay, so maybe the Founding Fathers were fed up with some overzealous taxation on the part of England. Douglas could literally have been killed for merely trying to learn to write his own name. Talk about gumption. This guy makes George Washington look like little Lord Fauntleroy. Douglas was then hired out to a shipbuilder named William Gardner on Fells Point, where he was trained to caulk the seams of a boat's hull, a step in boat construction imperative to ensuring water tightness. Caulking entails the use of a dull, flat, wide, chisel-shaped iron and a specialized mallet to drive gauzy cotton or oakum into the seams between the planks of the ship's hull. Once the seams have been packed tight with the ribbons of organic fibers, they are then covered with pitch. Douglas loved the work when he wasn't being run ragged all over the wharf and back, running errands for the rest of the crew, comprised of freemen, both black and white. Although he was earning wages, the highest wages paid to a caulker, in fact, he was still required to turn over every penny to Hugh Auld every Saturday night, which rankled all the more intensely since he felt so tantalizingly near to freedom, being paid for his honest labor. For so many people, the ocean, and particularly sailing boats, represent a sense of wide-open freedom. But for Douglas, working on the wharves every day, they had the opposite effect. He later wrote this moving recollection of his ill feelings toward the ships whilst gazing upon Chesapeake Bay, whose broad bosom was ever white with sails from every quarter of the habitable globe. You are loosed from your moorings and are free. I am fast in my chains and am a slave. You move merrily before the gentle gale, and I sadly before the bloody whip. Oh, that I were free. Okay, first of all, this language is from the guy who learned to write from ship parts, specifically beginning with A, F, L, and S. Extraordinary. But true. And this is just an excerpt of a paragraph that goes on 10 times longer, a heart-rending and elegiac bemoaning of his unthinkable condition. Second of all, when did we stop using O as an exclamation? It's so effective poetically as an evocation of longing or lament. Oh, I would like a delicious cheeseburger. Oh, I wish the people at the airport would not crowd into line like lemmings. Oh, I wish I were half as smart as Frederick Douglass. Beyond his secret Herculean efforts to learn his letters, Douglass was also required at times to call upon muscle of a wholly less figurative sort, as he was assigned tasks requiring more responsibility about the Auld's property. He also found himself more vulnerable to the overseer, charged with establishing the boundaries of those responsibilities. Douglass found himself offering defiance in the face of his oppressors, almost involuntarily at first, earning himself several vicious beatings, until he finally fought his overseer, a Mr. Covey, to a brutal defeat. My long-crushed spirit rose, cowardice departed, bold defiance took its place. And I now resolved that however long I might remain a slave in form, the day had passed forever when I could be a slave in fact. I did not hesitate to let it be known of me that the white man who expected to succeed in whipping must also succeed in killing me. So, you know, as a kid learning about slavery, I had been able to grasp the bullet points of horror. From the brutal and murderous capture of the African natives to the shackled forced labor and incredibly inhuman conditions of life working on a plantation. In my reading, I picked up further rapacious details over the years from the writings of Toni Morrison and Alice Walker and Uncle Tom's Cabin and The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn and more. And of course, I had seen Roots and Gone with the Wind and The Color Purple and 12 Years a Slave, and Glory, and their ilk. Consuming these narratives obviously made me no expert, but I had viewed and read of many harrowing and viscerally depressing accounts of life in the days of slavery. What I had not yet encountered, until I read Frederick Douglass, who penned 3 autobiographies, 2 of them before the Civil War, were the bald circumstances so succinctly rendered that a brain and spirit such as those possessed by Douglass were so effectively the worst nightmare of the white devil. So typically of the American media, Abraham Lincoln gets all the press when it comes to emancipation buzz. It brings to mind the way we, as a white people, were finally allowed to comprehend the plight of the Lakota Indian tribe, only when beautiful Caucasians, Kevin Costner and Mary McDonnell, went and lived with them in Dances with Wolves. In 1838, having navigated a daring escape from Baltimore by stealing aboard a freight train with the uniform and identification of a free black seaman, traveling by train and then steamboat to Philadelphia and finally New York City, all in fewer than 24 hours, Douglass finally succeeded in claiming his rightful place in the land of the free. He later wrote of his indescribable feelings upon the occasion at the tender age of 20. Anguish and grief, like darkness and rain, may be depicted, but gladness and joy, like the rainbow, defy the skill of pen or pencil. Before this book project, I did not realize what a singular Superman the abolitionist movement had found in Frederick Douglass. Right they were, the pro-slavery fucknuts, to fear that just such a firebrand as he would be powerfully instrumental in helping to bring about the end of slavery. I find it noteworthy that despite his superior wits, it was his hard work and elbow grease that ultimately earned him the opportunity to utilize his genius for language. Once he had escaped to the free northern states and settled in New Bedford, Massachusetts, Douglass was still unable to find work as a ship caulker because of prejudice. He was unfazed, exhibiting no apparent bottom to his well of gumption. Finding my trade of no immediate benefit, I threw off my caulking habiliments and prepared myself to do any kind of work I could get to do. Mr. Johnson kindly let me have his wood horse and saw, and I very soon found myself a plenty of work. There was no work too hard, none too dirty. I was ready to saw wood, shovel coal, carry wood, sweep the chimney, or roll oil casks. all of which I did for nearly 3 years in New Bedford before I became known to the anti-slavery world. The takeaway here is that this uneducated, escaped slave did not hesitate to perform any task of physical labor, as he said, hard and dirty work, in order to continue his rapid climb to the status of a free American who could use words like habiliments. He grasped, wittingly or no, the simple formula for success once he arrived in a sort of free country. Make your desired vocation known to those around you, then proceed to exhibit the most impressive work ethic in whatever occupation is at hand. Besides earning his keep by means of such labor, Douglas also joined the congregation of the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church in New York City, a black parish that included such abolitionist leaders as Harriet Tubman and Sojourner Truth. He quickly became a licensed preacher, as well as a Sunday school superintendent and sexton of the church. When examining photographs of Douglas, it's easy to understand why the arrival of this fiercely handsome and intensely intelligent young man, who could inspire the flock with his fiery oration and also fix the roof and doors of the church in a pinch, would incite excitement. His appearance and demeanor can be described only as those of a full-on badass. By age 23, he was able to conquer his nervousness about public speaking, and he began addressing anti-slavery societies and conferences all over the free states. In the eloquence of Frederick Douglass's oratory, the abolitionists had found a perfectly forged, priceless sword that wielded the devastating combination of searing common sense, an inspired talent for language, and a furious commitment to justice, all resting solidly upon the bedrock of his all-too-real history in bondage and brutality. Frederick Douglass continued to risk life and limb in disseminating his message, as even in free northern states he often faced violent opposition from pro-slavery factions. Many white males did not want to relinquish one iota of the unfair powers afforded them by the suppression of the rights of African Americans and women, and they weren't above resorting to intimidation to have their way. In fact, intimidation was often their opening move. It wasn't long before Douglass recognized the similar oppression being dealt to women of the age and allied their cause to his own. At the 1848 Seneca Falls Convention in upstate New York, Douglass said that he could not accept the right to vote as a black man if women could not also claim that right. He was quite aware that the world could begin to spin in anything approximating a rotation of fairness only if women were allowed to participate in the political arena as well. In this denial of the right to participate in government, not merely the degradation of woman and the perpetuation of a great injustice happens, but the maiming and repudiation of one half of the moral and intellectual power of the government of the world. Douglass's rhetoric carried a very clear message that was powerfully successful in slicing away so much of the bullshit surrounding the issue of slavery. Many filthy antagonists wanted to discuss the abominable practice as a matter of economics and financial health, going so far as to mask their avaricious intentions by suggesting that the Negro race was less human than people of other skin colors, a pattern of justice piloted by wealth that we'll see come up again in this book. It's amazing the wool the people in power of any nation will try to pull over the eyes of the citizens if there's a buck to be made. Unfortunately, human nature seems to allow this to occur regularly, out of laziness and ignorance. As Douglass penned, if there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favor freedom and yet depreciate agitation are men who want crops without plowing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its many waters. This struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one, or it may be both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. His cause was much more obvious some 160 years ago, since slavery, as well as women's suffrage, was such a clear and egregious violation of basic human rights, but it remains clear today, even after emancipation and integration and legalized voting, that the scales of justice are still considerably out of whack. Consider this quote concerning the law prohibiting African Americans to marry. "The marriage institution cannot exist among slaves, and 1/6 of the population of Democratic America is denied its privileges by the law of the land. What is to be thought of a nation boasting of its liberty, boasting of its humanity, boasting of its Christianity, boasting of its love of justice and purity, and yet having within its own borders 3 millions of persons denied by law the right of marriage?" This sounds rather familiar to me now, in a land where a percentage of the population is being denied their marriage rights in exactly the same way, based upon sexual orientation instead of skin color. Human beings are lazy. White people, especially males, still hold a disproportionate share of the political and financial clout in our country. If, as Douglass asserts, power concedes nothing without a demand, then it only stands to reason that these white men will not strive to right every possible wrong, refusing to rest until minorities and women are, say, earning a wage equal to theirs. We're lazy assholes. That's our nature. So I say let's at least cop to it. We haven't remotely righted every wrong. We've merely made things just good enough to stop people bitching as loudly. We eradicated slavery, and we gave blacks and women the right to vote, but doing so did not magically remove all the racism or sexism in the states, not by a long shot. In the June 2014 issue of The Atlantic, Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote an incredibly eye-opening essay about the issue of reparations toward the families of former slaves. I call it eye-opening because personally, as a relatively comfortable and therefore lazy white guy, I was not immediately aware of the severity of injustices still being practiced upon the black population by white people in power. I'm not suggesting I'm naive enough to think that racism hasn't continued its rampant destruction in our land, but this article was a much-needed wake-up call to the fact that mass organized discrimination is alive and well, just cloaked more effectively in mortgage scams and voter fraud. Voter intimidation, by the way, can be open to some pretty horrifying interpretations. In 1946, Theodore G. Bilbo, an elected Mississippi senator and proud member of the Ku Klux Klan, called upon his constituents thus, on the radio, no less: "Every red-blooded Anglo-Saxon man in Mississippi to resort to any means to keep hundreds of Negroes from the polls in the July 2nd primary. And if you don't know what that means, you are just not up to your persuasive measures." I was so grateful for Coates' article in a major national journal because it reminds us that although the initial sins of slavery and genocide are behind us, the mess we made in the commission of such sins is still clinging to our character with all the tenacity of the red, white, and blue, colors I'll remind you that most certainly do not run. The entire subject makes me angry and also embarrassed because I share a species with sad turds like this Bilbo person. As a human animal, part of me wants to retaliate against such unthinkable stupidity and evil in kind by punching my ham fist into someone's face. That Mississippi asswipe is thankfully dead, so maybe I should just go find another red-blooded Anglo-Saxon man to attack. They're all the same, right? Then I stop myself and say, okay, hang on, take a pill, No, those are addictive and bad. That's just what Big Pharma wants me to think. I'll take a breath instead. If Frederick Douglass and millions like him could withstand the animal temptation to take an eye for an eye after the plate of shit they were served, then surely I can refrain from punching out an Aryan Whole Foods stock boy. The point is that we are indeed all the same, not delineated by color or sex or any other factor. When Frederick Douglass began to publish his abolitionist newspaper, The North Star, in the late 1840s, he got it. The slogan of his paper was, "Right is of no sex, truth is of no color, God is the father of us all, and we are all brethren." Surrounded as I am by open-minded individuals with whose politics I generally agree, although they are comprised of many races and every category of sexuality and various religious beliefs, I can easily become inured to the fact that our manifest destiny attitude is still dangerously pervasive in many regions of this country. When news items or patriotic messaging that suggest our flag is a license to murder, or even just a gung-ho, extra-white country music video about America, reminds me unpleasantly of the absurd sense of entitlement we Americans seem to feel, since we butchered our way to the ownership of this land fair and square, I often wish I could call upon Frederick Douglass to cut to the heart of the matter for me, as my own clear thinking is clouded by confusion and animosity and shame. Oh, I can. In thinking of America, I sometimes find myself admiring her bright blue sky, her grand old woods, her fertile fields, her beautiful rivers, her mighty lakes and star-crowned mountains. But my rapture is soon checked. My joy is soon turned to mourning, when I remember that all is cursed with the infernal actions of slaveholding, robbery, and wrong, when I remember that with the waters of her noblest rivers, the tears of my brethren are borne to the ocean, disregarded and forgotten, and that her most fertile fields drink daily of the warm blood of my outraged sisters, I am filled with unutterable loathing. Part 2. Idealists. Chapter 5. The Bull Moose. Theodore Roosevelt. We have had an awfully pleasant look at four early examples of American luminaries, boasting a great wealth of character attributes worthy of emulation. Let us now leap forward with gusto to a fifth, an American for whom I have a healthy sense of rippling admiration. Theodore Roosevelt, our 26th president, was an avid sportsman, naturalist, writer, explorer, soldier, and historian, known for his lively, masculine personality and fondness for pugilism in both his backyard and in his politics. His interests were varied and rich, amply served by his voracious appetite for books, adventure, the society of people, wildlife, and the great outdoors. We largely have him to thank for our national park system, as well as a great deal more preserved wilderness, not to mention the Panama Canal. But before we get to that, let's have a peek at his childhood. Young Theodore was, for lack of a better term, a wuss. He was stricken with asthma, which left him debilitated, weak, and rather an easy target for the other boys to bully. "Having been a sickly boy, with no natural bodily prowess, I was at first quite unable to hold my own when thrown into contact with other boys of rougher antecedents." Ineffectual as he may have been on the playground, his prodigious brain was already enjoying an inspired regimen of reading, a pastime of which he never seemed to tire. A favorite title in his early years was the magazine Our Young Folks, which our young Theodore described as containing interesting stories in the first place, and in the next place teaching manliness, decency, and good conduct. Despite his sickly state, he was as smart as a whip and keen on any topic having to do with nature. After scrutinizing a dead seal at a local market, compulsively measuring the creature's head again and again, Roosevelt was finally awarded the skull, which he employed as the tentpole attraction in his first amateur Museum of Natural History at age 7, belying what would become a lifelong obsession with wildlife and its proper exhibition for public consumption. That seal filled me with every possible feeling of romance and adventure. He was determined to pursue the career path of a naturalist, a notion he eventually gave up, although his instinct to catalog wildlife would comprise a great deal of his life's writing. While hiking with his family in the Alps, a still wimpy Theodore happily discovered that the beneficial effects of the exertion were suppressing his asthma and bolstering his timid spirit. His father encouraged him to begin a program of rigorous exercise, including boxing and weight training, and this discipline had a tremendous effect in fortifying Roosevelt's morale. For the first time in his life, but certainly not the last, he understood that with a properly applied dose of gumption, he could accomplish much more than the recently apprehensive version of himself could ever have envisioned. "I felt a great admiration for men who were fearless and who could hold their own in the world, and I had a great desire to be like them." Theodore quickly came to love boxing, an exercise that not only exponentially improved his physical health, stamina, and coordination, but also fortified his self-confidence in physical confrontations. Reveling in his newfound strength, he set about to make of himself an ideal specimen of masculinity, in both body and spirit. He also found that he loved to row a boat, another invaluable labor that served to redouble his love of the fascinating scenery and bracing elements in the out-of-doors. I can personally attest that admiring nature from a boat, particularly one that is being propelled by one's own muscle and or one's own wife, has a nearly magical sense of satiated relish. He wrote, "I suppose it sounds archaic, but I cannot help thinking that the people with motorboats miss a great deal. If they would only keep to rowboats and canoes and use oar or paddle themselves, they would get infinitely more benefit than by having their work done for them by gasoline." Not only will such a strenuous program reinforce a body's muscle and circulation, but it also affords one the advantage of intimacy with all the ineffable pleasures to be found once one steps over the threshold of domestic comfort into the wonderland of woods or prairie. Perhaps within this sentiment lies a clue to enjoying one's life with a Rooseveltian vigor. By metaphorically choosing a path of more resistance, a person can provide stimulating challenges to him or herself on a daily basis. Roosevelt's encouragement inspires me to get outside and hike, bike, or row rather than remain in the homogenized climate control of the gym. I am also warmed by his sure-footed stance regarding the balance of play versus work in a healthy life. "Play should never be allowed to interfere with work, and a life merely devoted to play is of all forms of existence the most dismal. But the joy of life is a very good thing, and while work is the essential in it, play also has its place." In order to successfully execute such a life as Roosevelt's, it's apparently important to keep one's blood up, maintaining a steady focus on victory, all the while cultivating the horsepower to leap dynamically into action. "It is only on these conditions that he will grow into the kind of American man of whom America can be really proud," he said, but I'm sure he meant to include girls in that pronouncement as well. Theodore Roosevelt Sr. was a substantial supporter of his son's endeavors, morally and financially, as well as a role model of integrity. As number 26 wrote, "He combined strength and courage with gentleness, tenderness, and great unselfishness. He would not tolerate in us children selfishness or cruelty, idleness, cowardice, or untruthfulness, And I never knew anyone who got greater joy out of living than did my father, or anyone who more wholeheartedly performed every duty. Theodore Sr. died tragically at 46 of an intestinal tumor, while his son, 19, was attending Harvard. If he could have lived to see the life that Junior accomplished, he would certainly have been comforted by the striking resemblance the younger Roosevelt's ideals bore to his own. Theodore Roosevelt rode his proactive methodology straight into a political career that started in the 1881 New York State Assembly, when he became the youngest assemblyman on the floor by winning a Republican seat at the age of 23, charging immediately into the fray by staunchly opposing the rampant corruption he found there, led quickly to some heated altercations. As Edmund Morris writes, Big John McManus, the ex-prize fighter and Tammany lieutenant, proposed to toss that damn dude in a blanket, but fortunately Roosevelt got advance warning. Marching straight up to McManus, who towered over him, he hissed, I hear you are going to toss me in a blanket. By God, if you try anything like that, I'll kick you, I'll bite you, I'll kick you in the balls, I'll do anything to you. You'd better leave me alone. This event hardly proved to be singular, as the young assemblyman found himself establishing his turf again and again. They stopped at a saloon for refreshments and were confronted by the tall, taunting figure of J.J. Costello, a Tammany member. Some insult caused Roosevelt to flare up. Teddy knocked him down, Hunt recalled admiringly, and he got up and he hit him again, and when he got up, he hit him again, and he said, Now you go over there and wash yourself. When you are in the presence of gentlemen, conduct yourself like a gentleman. Such grit is certainly rare among the politicians I have watched in my life, and I am thrilled by Roosevelt's display of fisticuffs in the defense of decency. Part of my exhilaration is no doubt due to the fact that such a valorous example could simply not occur in our modern litigious society without the J.J. Costello suing the Roosevelt for his bloodied nose and bruised public image. I completely agree that we should always strive for decency and politeness, but the animal in me will never fail to enjoy a well-deserved ass-whooping. That is why I practice the policy of hug first. Surviving the jungle of American politics required a particular attitude of a man, which Roosevelt famously described thusly. He must walk warily and fearlessly, and while he should never brawl if he can avoid it, he must be ready to hit hard if the need arises. Let him remember, by the way, that the unforgivable crime is soft hitting. Do not hit at all if it can be avoided, but never hit softly. In the interest of maintaining his own ability to never hit softly, Roosevelt, now governor of New York, engaged the services of a championship wrestler to swing by the Albany office 3 or 4 afternoons a week to wrestle him. This program, agreeable to Roosevelt, did not, however, meet the approval of the comptroller. He refused to honor the bill for the wrestling mat, suggesting that a billiard table might be more appropriate. Roosevelt acquiesced by terminating the wrestler and hiring a professional oarsman instead. The oarsmen would also swing by the office, but instead of rowing, they would wrestle each other. By God, our man Roosevelt was going to see himself wrestled. This apparent solution didn't last very long either, however, as on the occasion of only their second grappling session, the oarsman had one of his ribs broken, while Theodore badly bruised two of his own and nearly dislocated his shoulder in the balance. Roosevelt finally but reluctantly relinquished his insistence that wrestling occur at his office. Later, in his administration as president, he decreed that each military officer should prove his ability to walk 50 miles or ride 100 in 3 days. Thanks to the stringent upkeep of his body's constitution, Roosevelt was able to withstand slings and arrows of every sort, figuratively, but also quite literally. While campaigning in Milwaukee in 1912, he was shot in the chest just as he was about to speak. The bullet passed through a thin steel case for his glasses and a 50-page copy of his speech folded in half in his inner breast pocket. Like some magnificent Hector, he merely paused, considered the wound, determined that it had not reached his lung and so was not immediately dangerous, then stepped to the podium to say, "Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know whether you fully understand that I've just been shot, but it takes more than that to kill a bull moose." Come on. What? Then he spoke for 90 minutes. Blood slowly soaked his shirt a bright scarlet, but he stood and staunchly delivered his oratory. It was later decided that the least dangerous solution was to leave the bullet in the muscle of his chest, and so he carried it there for the rest of his life. Gumption. Besides wrestling any strapping cuss he could get his hands on, Theodore Roosevelt also continued to see his love of the outdoors made manifest as he grew into middle age. There are men who love out of doors who yet never open a book, and other men who love books but to whom nature is a sealed volume. Nevertheless, among those men whom I have known, the love of books and the love of the outdoors, in their highest expressions, have usually gone hand in hand. Which means that if you're listening to this right now in the woods, or floating down the Sangamon River in your canoe, then you would have been held in high esteem by old number 26. Roosevelt's love of nature and adventuring led him to the great frontier beyond the Mississippi River, where he enjoyed the exploration of the wilderness almost as much as he loved hunting wild game. A well-born East Coast Yankee, he found that he flourished in the trappings and environs of the great hunters of the West, as well as the cowboy life of the great cattle ranches of his era. He even went so far as to try his hand at ranching in the Dakota Territory, a rugged and unforgiving land that brooked no weakness of body, or, as it turned out for a few unlucky thieves, of character. Whilst working the Elkhorn Ranch along the Little Missouri River in the early spring of 1886, Roosevelt and two companions awoke one morning to find that their boat had been stolen. The ice on the flooded river was just breaking up, rendering it extremely dangerous to navigate. The ranchers rightly suspected three known local horse thieves, but there was little to be done, as theirs had been the only boat known in the vast wilderness. Roosevelt and his companions, however, were not about to take this setback lying down. In a few days' time, they constructed a flat-bottomed skiff in which to give chase to the thieves. On top of his service as an assistant deputy in Billings County, Theodore Roosevelt also took this criminal action as an attack on his personal pride and safety. In the lawless wilds of the Badlands, where one couldn't call the sheriff or even send him a telegraph, a person needed to depend on himself for protection. As Roosevelt relayed in his book Ranch Life and the Hunting Trail, "To submit tamely and meekly to theft or to any other injury is to invite almost certain repetition of the offense in a place where self-reliant hardihood and the ability to hold one's own under all circumstances rank as the first of virtues." Naturally, albeit impossibly, Roosevelt and his merry men caught up with the thieves and captured them with no trouble. Now, normally in this wild land, as I've said, each man got to play judge and jury when it came to doling out punishment for known crimes. The three criminals were known to be wanted for not only cattle killing, but horse thieving, which was considered the greatest crime one could commit on the frontier, thereby punishable by an immediate hanging. Throw in the boat stealing, the rowboat was clinker-planked, no less, a hand-hewn craft made with care and skill, and nobody would have blamed Roosevelt for shooting these reprobates on sight. But that was not the way of our bull moose. He boated them laboriously down the river, commenting, The next 8 days were as irksome and monotonous as any I ever spent. There is very little amusement in combining the functions of a sheriff with those of an Arctic explorer. The weather kept as cold as ever. Roosevelt then marched him overland through ankle-deep mud for 36 hours to the town of Dickinson, and I was able to give my unwilling companions into the hands of the sheriff. Under the laws of Dakota, I received my fees as a deputy sheriff for making the 3 arrests, and also mileage for the 300-odd miles gone over, a total of some $50. Now, there is little about this anecdote that doesn't beg flat astonishment. I suppose the fact that they were running a cattle ranch in the wintry, Native American-infested wilderness can begin to give us an idea of their mettle to begin with. But by then literally risking their lives, Roosevelt and his 2 fellow champions amaze me. All done just to see justice served, for, as he described the miscreants further, they belong to a class that always holds sway during the raw youth of a frontier community, and the putting down of which is the first step toward decent government. The paperwork of decency was well ensconced far away in the more modern urban centers of government, so maintaining the integrity of the law on the frontier depended wholly upon citizens like Roosevelt and company. The second of my many favorite details from this story is the fact that these redoubtable cowboys, when faced with a seemingly irredeemable loss, simply gathered the best planks they could find along with some tools and a modicum of gumption, and built themselves a solution. One of the most venerable objects a human being can create, a wooden boat. Somehow, in my examination of a list of Americans with gumption, boats, particularly those crafted of wood, seem to keep cropping up in a substantial way. I may have to look into that as we proceed. The final tidbit from this tale, a story so heroic that it would have needed toning down if it were a Jack London fiction, is simply that in the midst of this chase, both when the pursuers would stop each night to camp and then after they had collected their quarry, continuing to camp at night, Roosevelt pulled out the only book he had brought along. As for me, I had brought with me Anna Karenina, and my surroundings were quite gray enough to harmonize well with Tolstoy. Most any one of us soft modern Americans would scoff, and loudly at that, were you to suggest that we trek out, even to the mailbox, in inclement weather. Theodore Roosevelt not only took it upon himself to achieve this vigorous pursuit worthy of an Indiana Jones movie, but he did so at times putting his feet up by the fire and perusing the Tolstoy novel in his pocket. What a stud. Among the many tributes to him in present-day North Dakota, including Theodore Roosevelt National Park, perhaps the most appropriately august recognition is to be found at the Pitchfork Steak Fondue, gleefully pointed out to me by that extremely well-traveled woman of letters, Sarah Vowell. Every evening round supper time, the cowboy chefs load several raw steaks onto a pitchfork and fondue 'em cowboy style. This, of course, means they dip them in a barrel of hot cooking oil. Imagine my shame to have been caught unaware of this repast of glory sizzling in our midst. By the time you are hearing this, I fully intend to have severally sampled this barrel-fried beef in the town of Medora, North Dakota, especially after glimpsing this tantalizing morsel in a review on the computer web. The fondue is served before the musical. Tickets booked. On a more sober note, it's hard to deny that Theodore Roosevelt's stance on many hot-button issues would not fly with our modern progressive society. His outspoken views on the American Indian and women, for example, would be enough to place him in hot water, and I don't intend to defend him. He was an irrepressibly virile man, the sort one might describe as macho, living in an era when such a personality could be richly celebrated and rewarded, particularly by the white supporters of an imperialistic American worldview. If one were to mount a defense on behalf of his principles, one might argue that his good deeds and acts of valor could be thought to far outstrip his rather archaic, occasional sexism and bellicose approach to foreign relations. The degree to which his misdeeds might overshadow his innocence is a complicated topic, to be sure, but in no arena so much as his love of killing wild animals. If one examines the young Theodore's fascination with a seal skull at age 7, then observes his penchant for not only claiming wildlife prizes of every stripe for his trophy collection, but assiduously cataloging them and describing their behaviors and habitats with a scientist's eye for detail, only then perhaps can one fathom the lust that besotted the man when presented with the teeming wilderness of the American West. Roosevelt was absolutely smitten with the romance of traveling into the unbroken frontier, tracking and stalking his prey, and then most of the time successfully shooting that prey for food or display. He killed a great many creatures, a hobby for which he received a lot of criticism even during his lifetime. As I have stated, I stand in support of hunting and fishing as incredibly satisfying methods by which to put dinner on one's table. If you are a person who disagrees with that stance, I'm okay with that. I just won't take you fishing. I feel that these, like all forms of harvest, should be performed responsibly with respect for the ecosystem and future generations, but that doesn't mean you can't have a beer in the boat. Now, killing critters, for a reason that doesn't involve a practical use, that is not my bag. Wasting a large elk because its head will supposedly look good over the fireplace does not appeal to me. But when such a sticky topic comes up, I try to remember that my own position has a lot to do with my time and place. I was brought up catching fish, not shooting bighorn sheep. If I had grown up in Colorado or Wyoming, or really just in a different family in Illinois, then I might well be an avid hunter. This perspective keeps me from feeling I need to judge the hunters, just because it's not what we did at my house. At the same time, I also try not to judge the folks who gripe about the hunters, because that's also not what flies in my house. A funny thing about Roosevelt is that when he wasn't out killing a large pile of black-tailed deer, he was fighting fervently to preserve our nation's forests and wild animals. The thing I try to remember about a figure like him is that, for all his epic accomplishments and feats of bravery, he was still a human being. This means he was as fallible as any of us. For example, how many of us rightly rail against the evils of corporate fast food fare, only to catch ourselves in the devil's drive-thru some late and ravenous night? That happens to me about once or twice a year, and I simply shrug and try to wolf down the briefly delicious, offending pap before it cools off and turns to inedible rubbish. This doesn't make me a supporter of fast food as a lifestyle. It merely exposes me momentarily as a human being who contains just the type of lager or weakness upon which fast food companies prey. We all have such weaknesses by definition, and understanding this to be true is an important step toward curtailing a lot of the whining we do about things like shooting a deer for venison or using a pair of leather work gloves. To my way of thinking, Roosevelt knew, or at least he intuited, that the type of unrestricted hunting he so enjoyed had a very definite expiration date. On one hand, he made incredible strides towards the preservation of nature in all her beauty with the legislation he passed and his instituting of our national parks. On the other, he swooped in and selfishly indulged himself on the flesh and blood fruits of that same nature's bounty for his own pleasure. In his defense, when he arrived at the party, there was still plenty of beer, as it were, but knowing well the magnitude of the approaching traffic, he was able to enjoy his sport while at the same time comprehending that such pillage must come to an end. In his book, Hunting Trips of a Ranchman, Roosevelt takes pains to obsessively detail each of 27 discrete species of quarry, their habits and attributes, and how best to hunt them. At the same time, he also speaks to the responsible thinning of the herds in order to preserve the wildlife from a conservationist's point of view. Thus, he manages to wear both hats even while hunting in his prime, which I feel speaks very well of his character. He did not approve of the killing of animals just for the sake of sport, but instead considered hunting just one of the avenues by which he could learn about the nature and topography of a given area. Consider this passage from The Wilderness Hunter. In hunting, the finding and killing of the game is, after all, but a part of the whole. The free, self-reliant, adventurous life, with its rugged and stalwart democracy, the wild surroundings, the grand beauty of the scenery, the chance to study the ways and habits of the woodland creatures. All these unite to give to the career of the wilderness hunter its peculiar charm. The chase is among the best of all national pastimes. It cultivates that vigorous manliness for the lack of which, in a nation, as in an individual, the possession of no other qualities can possibly atone. On one famously unproductive 1902 hunting outing in Mississippi, a scout finally snuck ahead and cornered and chained a black bear to a tree so that Roosevelt could claim its life and they could all go home. The scout was disappointed when the big game hunter refused to senselessly slaughter the shackled beast on the grounds that it would be extremely unsportsmanlike. Newspapers loved the story, and Clifford Berryman immortalized the moment in the Washington Post with a humorous cartoon of the scene. A Brooklyn candy shop owner saw the cartoon and got the idea to sell his stuffed animals under the new moniker Teddy's Bears, which is how the teddy bear got its name. And that's one to grow on. Even when Roosevelt wasn't in the woods, he was still avidly fueling his pursuit of the ideal masculinity for himself and also for America. While serving as William McKinley's Assistant Secretary of the Navy in 1897, he aggressively took over the command of our country's Navy, bolstering its readiness for battle. When war was officially declared with Spain, Roosevelt shocked those around him by resigning his civilian Navy post and enlisting in the Army so that he could go to Cuba and fight. He and Army Colonel Leonard Wood formed the 1st U.S. Volunteer Cavalry Regiment, which the press immediately christened the Rough Riders. Roosevelt once again proved his mettle, and then some, when he led the limping regiment uphill into flagrant enemy fire at the Battle of Kettle Hill. On the day of the big fight, I had to ask my men to do a deed that European military writers consider utterly impossible of performance. That is, to attack over open ground, unshaken infantry, armed with the best modern repeating rifles behind a formidable system of entrenchments. The only way to get them to do it in the way it had to be done was to lead them myself. Say what you will of the man, but he was as good as his word. When the going got tough, his rough-riding ass got going. So much so that this civilian volunteer was promoted to colonel during the fighting and nominated for a Medal of Honor. Upon his return to the States, he preferred being called the colonel, stating that the decisive battle had been the great day of his life. We should all be infinitely thankful that Theodore Roosevelt was on our side. In his political career, he worried no adversary more doggedly than the corrupt corporate influences that aimed to take advantage of the citizenry. To dissolve the unholy alliance between corrupt business and corrupt politics is the first task of the statesmanship of the day. As effective as he may have been, we apparently have not escaped this unholy alliance in our modern society, as Washington lobbyists openly spend billions on the purchase of congressional favors. Would that Colonel Roosevelt were present today to whip some sense into all of us. I'd love to imagine paddling my canoe down, say, the Snake River, with Roosevelt, he'd be in the stern, of course, and engaging him in a discourse about the great advances in equality between the genders since his day. That is, if I could get him to shut up about all the great blue herons dipping frogs from the shallow water. Despite his very vocal opinions on the proper indoctrination of boys and men, the colonel was also actually rather instrumental in the advent of women's suffrage on the eve of its success. His Bull Moose Party was the first political party to grant women any recognition in the voting arena, to the extent that Roosevelt's 1912 nomination was seconded at the Bull Moose Convention by none other than Jane Addams herself. The world was a very different place then, particularly in the way that the world powers regarded war, before either of the world wars had occurred. Roosevelt ruled in a different era, one in which a person could remain popular while also openly advocating for war. All the great masterful races have been fighting races is not really going to put you in the White House these days, which is why Ted Nugent has not yet seen a nomination. One could argue that behaving more or less like a man succeeded insofar as helping the Allies defeat the fascist Axis powers in World War II, but then the same brute force caused us to throw a couple of punches too many when we obliterated countless numbers of Japanese human beings by dropping atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I have to wonder what the colonel would have thought of our contemporary warfare that ultimately can be conducted from a distance of thousands of miles with the push of a button. Methinks he would have had a hard time finding the honor in it. That said, I wonder if I could convince Theodore Roosevelt, whom I would never call Teddy, as it was a nickname he despised, that perhaps what America needs, if we hope to evolve into a more decent people, is a little more of the woman's touch? When our citizens are determined to openly wear pistols on their belts to go shopping at Walmart, that signifies to me a failure on the part of the macho ideal. Ostensibly, the handgun is displayed to let evildoers know, in no uncertain terms, that this is not a person with whom to trifle. It then follows that the wearing of the pistol presumes a situation in which the bearer will need to shoot someone, rendering the brandishing of the weapon a badge of fear, does it not? It occurs to me that if we keep on turning to such masculine methodology to solve our conflicts, the only inevitable ending is a bunch of somebody's family lying in a bloody schoolhouse, movie theater, or smoking Japanese city. I guess we just hope it's not our family? I don't like the odds. As will often happen with me, an interesting train of thought will bring to mind a Tom Waits song. And Day After Tomorrow is one of his best ever, co-written with his bride Kathleen Brennan. You can't deny the other side don't want to die any more than we do. What I'm trying to say is, don't they pray to the same God that we do? Tell me, how does God choose? Whose prayers does he refuse? Sure, we and our allies have succeeded, so far, in keeping the specters of fascism and communism from overtaking the globe, but there are some extremists in the Middle East these days who are doing things in a way that's awfully hard to stomach. I think we have to examine how at least some of their hatred is fueled by a nation, us, that has succeeded in remaining the reigning bully on the playground for many, many decades. What do our methods amount to exactly? Have we taken their lunch money one too many times? 100 too many times? I can't answer that. I am literally just a handsomely paid wise ass, but I do think it's a question worth asking. Would Theodore Roosevelt, the man who said the most practical kind of politics is the politics of decency, approve of our casual policing wars? Hard to say, but given his stance on the amount of corporate influence governing these conflicts, I think no. All in all, the more I read about Roosevelt, the more human he seems, however inspirational. Whether or not I agree with all the strong opinions he held, I can certainly refuel my own well of gumption with the example he set, in a life packed to the gills with adventure. If I could go back in time and help out with his final bid for president, I would have suggested the campaign slogan, "Bull Moose, Balls Deep." I do believe we could have left Mr. Taft crying in his fat soup. In the final reckoning, I will always be grateful to Colonel Roosevelt for providing us with this instructional sentiment, which grows more poignant with every passing day. Far and away the best prize that life has to offer is the chance to work hard at work worth doing. Chapter 6. The Naturalist. Frederick Law Olmsted. So far, it's likely that my featured luminaries have been relatively recognizable to you. Although if you're anything like me, many of the details seem to have a hard time sticking, unless you happen to be a student of American history. One reason for this apparent glitch is the seemingly illogical, age-specific pattern of prioritization that our brains employ. Like, for example, the fact that I can still repeat from memory several phone numbers from my youth, not to mention the entirety of the rap song Jam On It by Nucleus, but now in my 40s, it's all I can do to repeat the finer points of a novel I just finished reading. In the parlance of this computer-style age, it would be nice to be able to empty the trash and make room for new files, as delicious as that rap song may be. Wiki, 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 wiki. Consider Herbert A. Simon, a right-sharp scientific thinker who did his thinking most frequently at Carnegie Mellon, by which I mean this chap was smart as shit. Check out some of his smart thinks right here. In an information-rich world, the wealth of information means a dearth of something else, a scarcity of whatever it is that information consumes. What information consumes is rather obvious. It consumes the attention of its recipients. Hence, a wealth of information creates a poverty of attention, and a need to allocate that attention efficiently among the overabundance of information sources that might consume it. A wealth of information creates a poverty of attention. Slogan worthy. Oh, and by the way, old Herbert blew that particularly salient jazz in 1971. Prescient as he may have been, he could have had no idea what the phrase overabundance of information would come to mean in 2015. I feel that I am in a constant battle with the media channels of the world, which are incessantly trying to penetrate the inner sanctum of my focus. Because if I switch on even one channel, be it TV, radio, or internet, I am immediately exposed to the distracting jingles and tits of advertising and corporate agendas. I can immediately feel my focus begin to erode. This constant, inexorable bamboozle, I believe, is also partially responsible for the paucity of attention that I am able to devote to any given subject. My copy of Huckleberry Finn may weigh more than a Kindle, but if I am reading it under a tree in Minnesota, I am in zero danger of any pop-up ads or other apps appropriating my focus. I am also unable to order any shoes online whilst in the middle of my story, perhaps digesting Huck's perfect rationale for pleasure boating. Other places do seem so cramped up and smothery, but a raft don't. You feel mighty free and easy and comfortable on a raft. And here's the thing. If I traveled all the way to the woods of Minnesota, and I don't already have upon my feet all the shoes I need, then I'm a fool. I digress. I wanted to crow to you about Frederick Law Olmsted, architect of Manhattan's Central Park, and I was going to presume that you are less familiar with him than with George Washington. Here we go! Please ring the appropriate enthusiasm from these exclamatory sentences!